whatever. And I remember the first time I ever thought about God in at least a superficial way was I was at my grandmother's apartment, and it was raining outside, and she drops one of those sayings that we have in Bulgarian. She says, "Hey, look, it's raining. It means that God is crying." And I thought to myself, what's grandma talking about? She's out of her mind. What's that thing, God? And I had some sense about it, but you know, it was a time where you couldn't go to church. You could not talk about God. You couldn't have a Bible. You couldn't share with anybody about God or anything. And so you just grow under this conviction and this basic statement that you're taught from kindergarten to university level, even at your workplace. And it goes something like that. There is no God. The human being is the center of the universe. That was like a slogan type of thing. And so there is no God, and the human being is the center of the universe. Up until communism fell apart. And God did an amazing work. And some people think it was Gorbachev and Reagan and all that, but I believe there were other forces behind that. And I hope some of you recognize that those battles are not on political level, but on a spiritual level. And so when that happened, the Holy Spirit moved mightily in the whole country. It was a nationwide revival. And right after that, probably within a year, year and a half, in 91, in the beginning of the year, I got my moment of getting to know God for the first time in my life. I had never seen a Bible. I had never prayed in my life. I had absolutely no understanding of anything outside of the human being as the center of the universe. And so it was a colleague of my mom. She invited us to go to a mass evangelism event, which was in a movie theater. It was packed, so packed that I had to stand up the whole time. It went for about maybe 3 hours. And they preached and they sang and preached and sang. It was like a big sandwich. But there was this one, I couldn't quite get everything that they were talking about, but there was this one song that really caught me, being a little bit of a musical person. It was one of those 7-Eleven songs. Have you heard of them? It's seven words, you repeat them 11 times. And so I figured out it was a deacon from the church, from the local church, that wrote the song. It was very simple. It was, Christ is lifted up and Satan is defeated. And then about 1,000 hallelujahs. And my problem, I was starting to get a sense of that Christ idea, that Christ name and God something. My problem was I had no clue what this thing Satan was. What's this thing that's defeated? Later on, of course, I found out. But that was my initiation, if you want, to the Christian faith, just getting to know anything at all about God. And at the time, you know, there were no Bibles. You couldn't quite just go to a store and get a Bible, because there were none. Some organizations from the West were smuggling during communism, very limited, of course. And then little by little, after things opened up, you know, Bibles started coming in. But you couldn't quite just go and get it, you know. So I started saving from my snack money little by little. And going to church, you always have to have your money with you, because a deacon would pop up. They went to the capital, managed to secure a few Bibles. They come back with a big, like a travel bag. And you see a deacon with a bag that's Bibles. And you run to them before it's too late, because everybody wants to get one. But that's how I got my first Bible. Started reading, devouring that Word of God. And that was a turning point. Everything was new. The Bible says that we are a new creation. Everything is already in the past. I was a high school student, just getting into high school. And the challenge was big, because the high school was about 750 kids. It was an elite language school. And the Christian kids, we were about 8 or 10. in that range. So you can imagine the pressure and the tension that was there. And then little by little, with media and the state and the local Eastern Orthodox Church is very much against anything that's different from them, Catholic or Protestant, anything that's not Eastern Orthodox considered as a cult. And so we started that battle, and the school was pretty hard, pretty tough on that side, because every day was a challenge. Even teachers would challenge you in class. The classmates would call you names and all that. But we went from classroom to classroom. And I just take my Bible and use the recess time and just enter one classroom, and I just tell everybody what happened. And to some it sounded crazy. It sounded like, what's this guy doing? What's he talking about? But later on, some of them actually came around and got to discover the Christian faith, which was amazing. And then very early, I sensed this call from God. I was looking, I was searching. The church taught us at the time that God never saved you just to be saved. That God saved you for a reason, for a purpose. And we all ask God and the Holy Spirit, can you show us? I want to know what you want me to do. How do you want to use me in this life? And very early, maybe within a year or two after I got converted, I started having this big desire to study. I don't even know how to share with you guys, but there were not a single Christian book at the time. You couldn't buy it. Couldn't get it. My first Christian literature that I could put my hands on was, you know, those carbon copies that you used to do, you know, back then. Somebody had taken maybe a book or just a text, and they had typed, like, that was probably third, fourth copy on the carbon thing. And then they just stapled it on the side. And that was the first book. And I remember it was some revival in Indonesia or some Asian area. That desire, I knew God is preparing, is starting to prepare me for something for the future. Now, I was just a high school student, but I had a big heart for what God had ahead. And so, realizing that it's great to be passionate, but it might help you if you're educated too, there came a moment when my wife and I came to the U.S. with the idea to go to seminary and study. And so, long story short, we ended up in Myrtle Beach, out of all places in this world. And that became our home, if you want, and our base, if you want. Sometimes I say it's our headquarters. You think of big buildings and, you know, those companies, but it's our headquarters. Our seminary was up in Charlotte, so we traveled quite a bit, and then we moved to Charlotte for a little bit and then came back. But we both graduated with theological degrees and counseling degrees as well. Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, you may have heard the name or not. Billy Graham was heavily involved with founding the seminary and sustaining and supporting it, but that was our area there. And then it was during that time, that's why I'm sharing the story with you, but it was during that time in seminary that God was shaping our thinking, shaping our calling, shaping our understanding of what He wants us to do more specifically. And it was in 2008 that we started noticing those students coming to the Myrtle Beach area. You may have heard of someone talking to you about J-1 students. That's because the visa that they get to come to the U.S. has this number, J-1. Each visa when you come to the U.S. has a number. And so it's J-1. Of course, we knew about them before, but somehow it was like scales coming off our eyes and realizing what's out there. And it all started very unplanned, which I really loved, because it wasn't with the mission board and all the budgets and everything set up and let's now try to figure it out. It was actually exactly the opposite. And so I believe the Holy Spirit was leading that, because it was, none of it was really planned in human ways or human efforts. But we just started seeing some of these students. And you've seen them around. You know, you drive on the bypass here. Cars are running like 55, 60 miles an hour. And you see a student with two Walmart bags just walking inside the road. Dangerous thing, but they don't even know it. But we'd see some of them like that, and we just pull over. Hey, you need a ride? Oh, sure. And they jump in the van, and we take them to their place. We saw a student one time had a flat tire at Target, trying to figure out how to, you know, where to buy a tube and all that stuff. So we're right there, 10 o'clock in the evening at Walmart with him, going back, buying a tube, changing it, you know, that tube, helping him and all that. But it started like that. And then we take some of these students and bring them to our home. It was in Saucastie at the time. So when people say, I mean, you notice I have a little accent probably, if you haven't. Sometimes people say, where are you from? And I feel offended, because I've been here for 15 years. And I have my game with people. I say, I'm local. And then you got to see the change on their face. And they say, you local? I said, yeah, in Saucastie. And that's another change. But it was in Saucastie. So we just take those students to our home, and we'd cook dinners and talk, and it was, you know, we started noticing something very special happening around the table. A lot of those students, of course, they come, they're on the dollar menu, because they come with very little, hoping to work, make some money, and pay their expenses and all that. And so anything that's a dollar is fair game. So for them to have a nice meal, and especially with Bulgarians, that's our national meal. We cook some national things, and some of them haven't had certain foods in a month or two, and suddenly there's a home-cooked meal that's exactly like home. It's like, oh my goodness. But that created that atmosphere where we'd sit at the table, and we would ask them questions about their family, about their country, about their studies, because most of them are students, college students. And so they tell us about their siblings, about their dreams for the future and everything. But at the same time, they would ask you the same questions. They'd say, what are you doing here? And we say, we're studying, we're going to school. And with most of these students, you wouldn't specifically say seminary, because they wouldn't even know what that is. A lot of them say, seminary, what is that? So we say university, and you study about God, something like that. And what are you going to be? If you say a pastor or a missionary, they have no clue what that is. A lot of them, like, what is that? So we'd say a priest. A priest always works, because they have this idea of a priest. Oh, okay, I got it. Some religious type of function. But it was around the table that we were discovering that atmosphere, that opportunity to share our lives, but also to start sharing the good news with people. And we never rushed too much through it. Instead, we were building relationships over the summer, and that became the foundation, the basis for getting their trust and getting the right to speak into their hearts. I remember a lot of these students, but if there's one that stands out in particular with the story behind it, it was around the 21st Avenue. You know, there's a Starbucks right there, and between some of the hotels there's a little park area with some cement benches, and it was late in the evening. We were sitting with that student, a guy from Bulgaria, a young man. And I had my Bulgarian Bible with me, and we were sitting there. That was towards the end of the summer, and I'm sharing the good news with him. And I asked him a question. I said, do you think you may sometime in the future, you know, think of turning to God and opening your heart to God? And he said, yeah. I said, well, do you think that might be sometime soon? He said, yes. And I said, well, since you say so, would you think that might be tonight? And he said, yes. And as we're getting ready to pray, well, first of all, he said, I've never prayed in my life. I don't even know how to pray. And I said, we'll take care of that. I'll help you. But you know, as we were getting ready to pray, he looked at me with this big question in his eyes and asked me that question that I think would be one of the most memorable questions for me personally for the rest of my life. He looked at me and asked me, why has no one ever told me about God's kingdom, about God and all that? And you know, I was sitting there, it was probably around midnight, with all my theological training underway, and I had no answer. How would you answer that question? What would you say? I mean, if somebody asked you that question, like, what would be your thought? How would you say, well, I don't know, or, well, we're maybe too busy in church, we do other things, or, I mean, what would you say? And I didn't know what to say, but I was very honest with him. I was very sincere, and I said, Jordan, that's a wonderful question. I really don't know how to answer. But I do know that God had a plan, that you'd be coming from Bulgaria this summer, and you'd be coming to Myrtle Beach, and that we're here, and that we live here, and that we'd meet, and that you and I'd be sitting here tonight on this cement bench, and that you would have that opportunity to hear about God. And so that memorable question remained, and then over the next few summers, we realized, we got to this big realization where it's just the two of us. And there's 3,000 or 4,000 students out there. And so the words of Jesus couldn't be more stunning at that point. You remember in the Gospel of Matthew, he says, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And if you're a careful reader of the word, you'd notice he doesn't say there are no workers. He says there are workers, but they are few. They are not enough. They're not sufficient. Oh, I got to tell you, we felt that in a very, very personal way. And so the next year we continued, and the following year we continued until the dream came around. And we sat and thought about this and said, well, listen, this is just not going to work like that. It's just two of us, and there is just no way we can reach out to so many. And so we thought, what if churches got involved with their buildings, with their mission funding, with their people power, men and women of God who are ready to be workers in the field? And then we approached a few churches, and there wasn't quite a good response. It was a little bit of a church response. There's no money. And we were a little discouraged. So we thought about it again, and we prayed about this. And then Seacoast Vineyard Church had just moved into their new location right off Oak Street. And I knew the pastor. We were not very close friends at the time, but we knew each other. And we thought, let's go and just share with them and see what they think. And so we went and sat and talked with Tim Holt, pastor there. And it took just a few minutes. He said, I love it. I've got to show you something. I said, all right. Takes us out to the other side of the building and shows us a room that's being torn apart and says, God told us to transform this space into a cafe for outreach. We have no clue how we're going to use it specifically, but we're just following what we believe God told us to do. And we looked at each other. We were right in front of the door. And Mr. New has been there. He's seen the location. We just looked at each other. He's a little taller, so I was looking up a little bit. And I told him, I said, I think we just figured out what it could be used for. And we both smiled. And I told him, I said, they will come. You know, those folks will come. And then it took about 2.5 years to 3 years. We never heard back from them. It was a mystery. We were, again, a little discouraged. But one day, we got contacted by some of the mission people there. And they said, we've never met. We don't know anything about you. We just heard about what you're doing. And we have no idea how to do this. But we need to meet so we can figure that out. So we met. And the rest is history. I believe 6 years ago now, That's going to be, I think, the sixth summer. The All Nations Cafe started at Seacoast Vineyard Church, and in fact, the All Nations name came right from my wife's thinking. She thought, "Hey, we're trying to reach the nations. How about All Nations?" And they picked that up as well. And so it's been developing. That's kind of the front of the one side of the building. It outgrew that little room that they were thinking of using as outreach, so they continued expanding into the building. So now the whole building's pretty much flooded on Tuesdays and Wednesdays every summer for students. Students are coming. They're having a free dinner. Churches now are providing meals, and that's... I would venture to say that this is probably the one project that unites the most Christians in churches and ministries in this whole area. So it's just wonderful to see the growth, and they're now locally governing this whole project. Seacoast Vineyard is the hub, if you want. That's kind of the central location, and now obviously the gentleman from Ocean View Baptist, that's going to be a new site for this year. But my wife and I basically remain on the front line. We don't want to waste time with anything else than what we call mingling. Did you know mingling is a ministry? Yeah, it's the gift of mingling. You mingle with people and you get to know them, and you establish relationships, and then little by little you narrow it down, and then you start taking them to your house and offering a dinner and helping them, you know, get their social security number, or go and find something in the store that they have no clue where it is, or they have a specific problem with a landlord or their housing, and then you help them through that. And all that creates an opening into their hearts. Of course, we can share a bunch of stories, but I think my wife would agree that's probably one of the coolest story, I guess, especially from my last year. I was sharing with Mr. Neil, it's been interesting, you know, the first years we would see a lot of Eastern Europeans, predominantly I would say, plus other nations, but the last few years you see just a growing population of students from South America, and then a lot of Asian students, and a lot of Turkish students. A lot of Chinese students, you know, Asia region, different countries, but Chinese, which is very surprising. Even to us, that's a new experience because we haven't had that specific encounter in the past. But last year, there was one girl that, in particular, that my wife Ellie was connecting with. Her English was real funny. She was good at English, but very difficult to understand because of her very thick accent. But my wife kept meeting with her and working on that relationship. And towards the end of the summer, she came around and professed faith in Jesus. And she wanted to have what? She wanted to have a Bible and a cross. And so my wife got her a Bible and a cross. But the coolest part, you know, as she was leaving, she told my wife she got from the church six, you know, those little cups for communion, like an individual cup. She got six cups to take with her back to China. Just a wonderful, wonderful story to see how God moves, even in someone that you're not quite sure how much they understand you in terms of language, and sometimes you have a hard time understanding. She always went with her phone and translating over the phone and filming and all that, but we never heard anything back from her since she left. And I think you'd understand why when she goes back to China. I think a lot of their social media is probably censored. I'm not sure, but I don't think we've heard anything. And my little boy would remember her name. What was her name, Stevie?
Chuan Chu.
Chuan Chu. That's a name right there. We don't hear that name quite a lot here, but We're excited to be part of the All Nations Cafe. Summer is coming up, so we're kind of gearing up for this. In fact, mid-May, towards the end of May, that's kind of the big flow of students starting. And then beginning of June as well. And then everybody's pretty much here, so they're trying to get a second job and work hard and all that. But a wonderful opportunity for churches to get involved and for young people from those countries to hear about God. And, you know, the trickiest part is that in most of these countries, the Christian population is less than 1% or 1%. Eastern Europe, like take Bulgaria as example, in the 1% they include the whole evangelical community plus all the cults and sects and all that. That's like, and that's even stated as less than 1%. So imagine the scale of Christianity, the way we understand it, the scale of Christian ministry. There are churches, there are ministries, there are mission organizations on the ground, but when you think about that scale, you cannot be indifferent to the challenge there. Now, not even talking about China and Turkey, that's even a different ballgame, because that's already a closed environment. You cannot even openly talk. But just an amazing opportunity. As far as our main work, yeah, I was going to say table talk, as I shared with you about how things started with students. Now you probably understand why formally, officially, we called our organization Table Talk International Ministries. But besides our summer efforts, our main focus is really on fulfilling the Great Commission. We have one command given by Jesus, and it is as simple as it gets. It's make disciples of all nations. Teaching them, baptizing them, and all that, serving that goal and that purpose to make disciples. This is how all our ministry, individually, as a church, as a Christian community, as the church global, will be one day evaluated. That's the only thing that would have eternal relevance that God will look at and say, man, that was good. You made disciples. That's going to be the criterion by which all our work is going to be checked and evaluated for real success. And so my wife and I committed to this ministry. It was in seminary that we were asking God, well, Lord, we're getting all this great education, best in the world, but how do you want to use it specifically? I mean, we can preach, we can teach, we can do a lot of things, but what do you want us to do? How do we go out and do it? And I was in a class with a world-renowned professor, Robert Coleman, especially in the field of disciple making and evangelism, one of Billy Graham's people and all that. And at the end of that class, I knew God was talking to me. We came back from Charlotte, went to Sacristy, and so it was in the evening. It was April the 4th in 2009, and I went to bed. And I had, which I would describe as some sort of visitation from God. And my heart was very heavy for God's ministry. And my tears were just flowing. And I knew the Lord was doing something in me. I wasn't tired. I wasn't sick. I wasn't sad. You know, the normal things that would make you cry. But I remained in my bed. And I knew the Lord was moving in my heart. And I don't know how long this continues. Maybe like, I think probably like 40 minutes, 45 minutes. But I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that God was telling me, make disciples. That's what you're called to do. And so I prayed that night and I said, Lord, I commit today that for the rest of my life, I'm not going to do anything else but fulfill the commission that you've given us to make disciples. And so later on, we took a little cherry tree, planted it in the front yard. We called it the tree of discipleship. So every morning you'd wake up and open the blinds, and the first thing you see sideways in the front there would be the tree of discipleship. As a reminder, every day that you walk out of the house, what did God call you to do? It's to make disciples of Jesus. And so our whole ministry is spinning around that commission of God, that command that we've taken very seriously. Now, as I say discipleship, and I know I'm getting a little bit into teaching, but I love to share my heart with you tonight, not just share facts about ourselves. Discipleship in the last few years in the U.S. has become a buzzword. I go to churches, I visit with ministries, I talk to missionaries, and a lot of people talk about discipleship. It's a word that comes up all the time. But the sad part is that in a lot of circles, a lot of places, you ask them, what is discipleship? Or you ask church leaders, how do you make disciples in your church? And then you get this blank face. Which tells me that we kind of know about it, we think it's important, but somehow the church altogether is struggling with making disciples. I do believe, though, that if we fulfill the command of Jesus by the guidance of the Holy Spirit and His empowerment, we can see this world reached out with the good news of Jesus in our generation. I know this may sound like crazy to you, but Jesus had a plan. He gave us a command. If we just follow His command and fulfill what He told us to do, focus on that one command, there's a realistic chance that we will reach out this world with the good news. And so that's what we committed our lives and our work, our daily life. And people ask us, what do you do on a daily basis? Just like my son, he went to school and he loves school. And he quickly figured out that there's after school care. And he asked, well, why can't I stay for after school care? And I said, well, you know, after school care is for kids that, you know, parents are working, they finish at 5 or whatever, so they need to have a space where they can keep playing and learning and stuff, and they pick him up later. And he said, okay, why don't you go to work so I can stay for aftercare? And so he got this idea that, you know, somehow we kind of pick him up and take him up there. And but one of the things that we do, trying to model the example of Jesus, is we invest ourselves into one-on-one relationship. As you can see, that word relationship keeps popping up in what I'm sharing with you. But we select individuals that we start investing in. We pour our lives into their lives. It consists of meeting most of the time weekly, spending a few hours together, and then studying the Word together, talking about life and anything in life, talking about family and friends and ministry and church, evaluating their place in life and ministry, encouraging them for ministry. And so that's one very basic thing where we start. It's the one-on-one relationship. Ultimately, within a year or 2 years of long-term investment, we can see people turning around and now starting to be able to get to the point where they can start training people themselves, which is the whole point. Of course, my wife works with, that's just a small chunk of the women that she's involved in and has been involved in. But the women to women, some of these relationships are more start as a counseling relationship because there's a need, and little by little she turns it into more of a personal relationship and discipleship journey. And then in a different format, we do this with couples, so couple to couple. We've discovered in our experience itself that it's a powerful way to minister to couples because it brings a perspective of a whole couple. It's a man and a woman directly addressing a man and a woman. And it's just wonderful, wonderful thing to see how whole families come around and they step on a different platform for their own spiritual development, but also for their children, for their church, wherever God has planted them. And so those are the two areas, and then a third area would be specifically focusing on equipping church leaders, because that's a key section that if church leaders pick up the idea of discipleship, then the church will pick it up. Then the church will be able to get into discipleship strategies and how we reach out the world. And so we conduct different trainings with, of course, signature training on basically how to make disciples. It's a full-blown course that we offer to churches and ministries. And then we also do different studies and seminars on different subjects, from conflict resolution to forgiveness and other topics, biblical theology and whatnot. But that's a church setting, like these folks here on the pictures are from the Greenville, Spartanburg area. Church plants, actually, younger church just started. They needed some help with their initial stages and trying to figure out how to get into discipleship and evangelism right away. And then finally, reaching to the nations. I know this evening is dedicated more to the local, but you cannot be too local, because the world is a global world today. And it's interesting if you think about it. In the Bible, there's no distinction between local and international missions. We do it more for financial purposes in churches, for budgeting and all that, but you don't really see a differentiation between local, national, international. And so one of the important areas that we've discovered is immigrant communities in the U.S. I don't know if that may surprise you or shock you if I shared with you that, let's say, in Chicago, in the Chicago area, there are 300,000 Bulgarians. 300,000. A country of about 7.5 million. So think percentage-wise, and just the number of people at one place in an immigrant context. 300,000. Every time I share this, it blows my own mind, because I'm thinking, that's a big number right there, you know. There's a few local churches, small churches, they're trying to reach out, but they need some help. So we'd go up to Chicago, the Boston area, much smaller community, but still a lot of opportunities there. We come alongside the church and help the church get into evangelism, discipleship, help them with seminars, trainings, leadership development. And it's a very, very important area within communities. In Myrtle Beach, I don't know if you know that, but there's a Russian community. There's an Albanian community, speaking of Albania. There's a Bulgarian community. It's a very international place. You wouldn't think, because it's more like tourist area, you think, it's just, you know, a bunch of Southerners. But I'm a Southerner too. I come from Southern Bulgaria, so, and it's true. It's not just a. it is true. It is true. And so that's pretty much all I have to share with you. I would love to answer any questions. As faith missionaries, we basically rely on monthly support and gifts of individuals and churches, just like you guys. And we welcome any support. Our ministry operates under Christian Aid Mission, because we're not a huge organization. It's much more efficient to be under a bigger umbrella organization. And so a 501c3, it's accredited by the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. I think Mr. Neil put some cards in the back, so you can get a card that have pictures and everything. We look good in the pictures. So I really want to thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure to be with you. I look forward to the Good News Club. I enjoy it as much as the kids do. So what's Jesus saying? We need to be like the kids. There you go. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let me introduce myself. This is nice. Actually, the timing is perfect. As I said to Neil today, talk with you briefly if you're not that familiar with the Good News Network. But 2 years ago today, my program Night Watch debuted.
May 1st, 2017. And I didn't even realize that when Neil asked me this, but it's nice. Good News Network, some know here. I know that some of you listen to it. You have told me that. They have a translator on one of the hotels downtown. Paul, which one is that? Which hotel is it? Do you remember?
Paradise or Palisade?
Palisade, I think it is something.
Palisade.
Yeah, you know, it's just, it's that hotel on the beach. There's not many of them. And the Good News Network started in Augusta, Georgia. It will be 25 years ago this November. And it was the brainchild of a man now 86, who was 61 at the time. And as his friends say, when he retired at 61, he had enough money to last for probably 50 lifetimes. And he is one of the most frugal. He uses the word chintzy and tight. He's just incredibly frugal. He has used a lot of money to build this network through the years, and I totally take my hat off to him for it. His name is Clarence Baranowski. He's 86 going on 50. And his son Mark, who also works with him in their other businesses, will be the one who eventually will be my boss when Daddy finally stops. And that will happen only when he breathes his last. But they started it at Bethany Chapel in Augusta, Georgia, one of our favorite places. It actually closed, sadly, last year, and 2 miles from the Augusta National Golf Course. But they started it in a Sunday school room, and they began with one little tiny station. And now they have, this is their map. I just kind of printed this off. I didn't think of doing a transparency, but they have 20 English-speaking stations through the Southeast. They're in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi. And as of Friday of this week, a 21st station will go on the air in Macon, Georgia, and Peachtree City, Georgia. I don't know if you realize this, but if you buy a radio station, it takes sometimes 2 to 3 years, I'm told, to be able to get through all of the paperwork and the FCC due diligence and the requirement. And each station will cost anywhere from $3.5 to $8 million for each station. Previously, their newest station actually was in Fairbluff, North Carolina, right by Whiteville. And that's the one, frankly, that I listen to when I want to listen in. They serve North Myrtle Beach. There are some here who listen to 96.7 here in Myrtle Beach, which is actually a translator on that hotel taking the signal from Florence and beaming it. And they're actively looking right now for land. The requirement, generally 5 acres of land in the Myrtle Beach Conway area. They'd love to build a station here. They also have 4 Spanish-speaking stations. Talk about an international outreach, and so it's quite a ministry. The father and son who own it have not taken the first penny in salary in 25 years. It's all gone out. And it is a totally listener-supported network. They have never run the first advertisement. I think it's actually pretty remarkable. Clarence loves to brag about the fact that he runs the tightest, cheapest Christian radio network in the United States. And 25 years later, with 25 stations as of this week, they still have 2 full-time employees. That is it. 2. And they have a contract engineer that they call in, and he kind of, they have a pickup truck for him that's all laden down with his ladders and equipment and everything. And he does the rounds whenever there's new things need to be replaced in their satellite dishes and whatever. And they pay him just as a contract, but 2 employees. It's really remarkable. It is a station that does have some music programs, but in an age of K-Love and all of the contemporary Christian all music all day stations, they're kind of the old school, and so they're pretty pleased with the fact that you can listen to John MacArthur and Dr. David Jeremiah and all the other doctors, Stanley and Dobson and Swindoll and Adrian Rogers and Ravi Zacharias and even J. Vernon McGee, dead for 15 years, somehow still talking. And that you can listen to a number of preaching stations. They have a really pretty nice website. It's gnnradio.org. And when you go on there, this has been the biggest eye-opener for me since my involvement, but if you go on there, there is a Listen Now tab. And so people are listening via the computer, and that shocked me. 2.5 years ago, I was at a funeral in Augusta, and I'm standing in a long line waiting to come up and pay my respects to the family, and somebody pulled my suit coat. And I turned around, and it was the son, Mark, and he said, "Dad and I would like to talk with you before you leave." And I thought, first thought, what have I done now? And so I said, what's going on? And he said, "Nothing. It's all good. Just hang on. But don't leave right away," because I was out and then coming back on the same day. And so I went and I met with them, and they said, "Let's go into a room." Turned out it was the exact same Sunday school room at the same chapel there in Augusta where the radio network started. And they made me the first offer they've ever done in their careers, and I've really, really, really been honored by it. They asked me if I wanted to produce an hourly radio program Monday through Friday on their channel, on their radio network. And I said, "Wow, I've never done that before. My music albums have been played for 40 years on the radio, and I've done some interviews, you know, in radio stations, but I've never done this. I like talking to mingling. I like talking with people. Sitting in a room, my office, looking out a window and at burgundy curtains. You don't get a lot of feedback from curtains." And I thought, how am I going to do this? And the learning curve, frankly, was a lot. It was something else. But we kicked it around for a while, and they sent their contract engineer with his pickup truck, and he brought a lot of equipment, and we set it up in our former home, and it just, I looked at it, and it was like, what now? But he tried his best to help out. And by the way, there is an engineer for Fox 43 right here who also does work for the other channels here, 1315. He knows all the people. Turns out he's a believer, and he donates his time to the Good News Network. And he came out to the house once for 5 hours, and he was the guy that really got me up and running. We started a program. I had to have 100 hours completed before they would start to air it. And it took 3.5 months to do that of an average. He didn't see me much, but it was an average of about 35 hours a week on top of everything else that I have to do to get to that 100 hours. Just trial and error, and I would send them programs, and the old man is blunt. And he called me one day, and he said, "I think we made a mistake asking you to do this program because those stink." So with that encouragement, I kept going on. And finally, I think we've got it ironed out, and it's gone well. I started at 5 to 6 in the morning. We've named the program Night Watch. Kind of a double play on words. It's at night. It's usually dark, 5 to 6. But also, we kind of like it because we are in, as a church, we're in the night watch. You know, we're in the fourth watch of the night right now, just before the Lord returns. So that was the name of the program. Started at 5 to 6. I'm now 4 till 6 in the morning. So what we're doing, as of this morning, for instance, the 354th program that I recorded, regular program, non-holiday, aired this morning. And it will rebroadcast then at 11 o'clock tonight. So what they have done then, they went back, they've put me now the extra hour from 4 till 6, they went back to program 100. And so the listening audience, gratefully, it's growing amazingly. Today, I answered 16 messages from listeners, And the one of them, this guy just has touched my heart. He's my age, like 43, 4. No, he really is my age. And he and his wife, their kids are grown and gone. And I can't imagine doing this. They have 8 foster children right now, he and his wife. And they're homeschooling them. And he gets up every morning at 4 o'clock and begins to cook breakfast. And the radio is on. And he listens to the 2 hours of the program every morning. And I was in tears today at the stuff that he was sharing and what it means before they start their day. And it's going on a lot. One of the things, as I mentioned, that has been an enormous surprise to me has been I have heard from Australia, New Zealand, the Caribbean, 8 or 9 European countries, Malaysia. Oh, goodness. Just an enormous number of countries of people who somehow found the website and they listen to it, including businesses where the radio is playing. GNN through a computer is being played all the time. And so while everybody thinks it's terrible that I have to get up at 4 in the morning to talk on the radio, and it was recorded weeks before, you know, it could be 3 or 4 in the afternoon down under. And people are listening. And I'm hearing from these folks. So I asked them, I said, just out of curiosity, what could the listening audience be like? Now, for 30-whatever years, I have traveled mostly to smaller churches like this. And they tell me that radio demographics are even harder to come up with than TV. You really never know who's listening. They have factors that they have built up of, for every person who contacts you, that's a representation of X number of people that never contact you. However they do it, they're telling me that somehow in the world right now, 500,000 to 1 million people could be listening every day to Night Watch. How many churches would I have to go to hit that number of people? It's a great opportunity for the gospel. I do 2 main speaking segments in each hour. Each hour is 55 minutes, 5-minute news break. And I speak from 23 to 28 minutes out of the 55, and the rest is music. I get to choose 2 of the songs that follow my 2 main speaking segments, which are 3.5, 4 to 6 minutes long. They're the only 2. That I choose. GNN has a database of 33,000 songs that are on my computer at my office, and I have to select 2. The computer randomly shuffles and generates all of the rest. And so it's every week is those 10 main segments, which is like preparing 2 mini messages. They're sometimes harder than long messages. To say what you need to say in 4 to 6 minutes can kind of be tough. I've written 180 devotionals so far that I've read in that. There are others that I'll get from Streams in the Desert, some of Dr. Jeremiah's devotional books, or just a whole library of them. The one that most people seem to like the best is, so far I'm right now at about 240 stories behind the writing of famous songs and hymns. And people are always asking, can you please, you know, scan and email me whatever notes you used or whatever book you read that from. That's our favorite hymn, and we really wanted to hear that. It's been an enormous labor of love, just absolutely loving doing this program. I think as time goes on and it is harder and harder for Donna and me to travel, this probably is our future. That's what I'm thinking. So we will see. They ultimately want me to do 4 hours through the night. So that will be 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, and 5 to 6. And it will take a while to get up there. So far we're nearing 450 programs recorded, including the Christmas month and Thanksgiving program, you know, those kind of things. Even Valentine's Day, I have programs for Valentine's Day on songs about love. And patriotic, they want patriotic days, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, the 4th of July. I have to do special programs for that. So it's a pile of work. Even now that I kind of have things going and under control and a little bit of experience, it's still about 20 hours out of our week. And there are a number of Wednesday nights. If you don't see me here, I'm probably recording or trying to get ready to record. The old fella is demanding 10 weeks ahead. And as of tonight, I recorded a week so far this week. He wants me to record two more weeks of programs this week before we leave for Texas on Saturday. And so it's probably going to be about a 45-hour radio week, period. And that's nothing to do with cutting the lawn or anything else. So I'd appreciate your prayers. It's a big road for an old man, but I am loving it. And if you ever get the chance, if you're up early, by all means listen. Give me your feedback. I've made some great changes thanks to suggestions from people that I may never meet. And two of the biggest ones have come from people that I can't even to this day remember their names. But they went on the Facebook page, Night Watch with Alan Parks, and they contacted me and they said, "What would you think if, have you ever considered..." And they've shared it, and it's just been absolutely fabulous. So thank you. Above all, keep praying.
Florence, we listen to Florence. In Conway, you get Florence Station. 97.
You do. That's 91.7.
And then the hotel right in Myrtle Beach, locally, you can get it almost to Conway's 96.7.
Oh, your 91.7 is what you listen to, and 96.7 here in Conway.
Because that comes from Florence.
Yep.
96.7 is on the hotel, and you can get it up and down the beach.
Yep.
But then when you get to North Myrtle Beach, it's 105.3.
105.3, that's the one out of Fairbrook. Yeah. Yeah, they actually bought what was a beach music station. And the equipment that
it works good. You can get the internet.
Internet's amazing. Yeah. So I say God bless them. This man could have spent his money on anything he wanted, but look what he's done. And they're hearing all the time about souls being saved. And I can promise you a lot of Christians being blessed. So thank you.